Good afternoon, good evening.
Hello, good evening.
I don't remember. Did I say it was Bernice's name that was had to evacuate?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand you. Blurry.
No, when I mentioned that somebody had to be evacuated, did I mention it was Bernice?
No, but I had a feeling it might be, because I knew she was from California. Is her house involved?
No, it's not that close, but they're still under evacuation because of the embers.
Yeah, so, and probably smoke is real bad.
Yeah,
because I know sometimes it reaches as far as Colorado. I have a friend that when she was in Colorado, a time before that the smoke reached all the way to Colorado.
It's our age. It's just the smoke could be is worse than anything else.
Right.
Nothing's worse than, having it destroyed.
Right.
So I was just letting you know.
Yeah. I heard you. And I figured it was she.
You doing all right? How's Tony?
Well, he's doing okay. Wednesday we see the doctor, the surgeon that we were supposed to have seen. when his last stint didn't last. So hopefully we'll find out what the next step is going to be. We got his temperature and his blood pressure every day, he's doing okay.
I'm surprised that the stint doesn't last like that. That's really unusual.
Well, it's because the stents are not, I should say the bile ducts are very, very small. They're milliliters.
Right.
And so the stents are not like other stents, the heart and veins, and they said the kidneys, and I don't know, he named another organ, that those, they have real good results. But that particular part of the body, they don't. They haven't perfected. Not even the metal one. And I assumed that the metal one meant, really good. But he said even the metal ones give them trouble. So, we really just don't know what to expect. A little bit. I mean, when they told us 3 months, we thought that meant that you had to have it removed before 3 months. But, one doctor told us he had one that didn't last but 2 days. So, But
hello,
we keep our eyes on Hashem and not the stent.
Of course, that's the source.
Right.
Brandy, you're here?
I'm here.
Okay, so we're going to move forward. The class is available in row 14, the second column from the left on the Yeshem matrix. And when the landing page opens up, scroll down to class 24C. And that'll open up to Levels of Teshuvah, Chapter 21, Section 4A. And I'm waiting for Hannah to tell me that that's where we are.
Well, I was talking to Jamie about the names of the... for Daniel, and we were working on that, so I'm having to look. Chapter 21, 4A. Yes,
right.
Repeat next week. This is our third time. It ought to be a charm. We should get
hopefully
it today.
Yeah, it's always good to have information on Teshuvah.
Yes.
Okay. We'll begin with the L'shem Yichud.
Oh, okay.
L'shem Yichud could gabri hu ishkinte bit hilu urchimu urchilu urchilu urchimu. Le'akta l'shem yud he bavate yichuda shalim b'shem kol Yisrael. Limud Torah mitzvah. La'asot Torah mitzvah. Vayihino amadunai Elohinu aleinu ma'asei yadenu kanenei aleinu ma'asei yadenu kanenehu. The second level within Asiyah is when Tiferet becomes disconnected from Bina as well, in a way that causes Asiyah to descend to the first three Sephirot of the Klipot. It is caused by the transgression of a positive mitzvah. This teshuvah is also called teshuv he, since it causes the lower he of malchut to be reconnected to the upper he of bina, in turn allowing tiferet to ascend as well. Welcome, Malka. We're starting on class 24C. You can find the handout on the Revealed Wisdom Matrix in row 14, second column from the left.
Thank you.
And what I just read is to begin to understand the metaphor that they're using right now on the Sephirot is the one that Hana constantly refers to, which is the diagram of a human being, where you have the head representing the upper three Sephirot, and then the upper part of the body from the hips above to the neck is the Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet. And then the lower part of the body being the Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. And with the tenth being Malchut. And they're describing the movement of the Sephirot, which is relating, and they're relating it to the Tetragrammaton, to the four-letter name of God, and how the letters get separated. So we're dealing in the world, the lowest world, the world of Asiyah, the world of Malchut. And they're saying that when someone does not do a positive mitzvah, Tiferet, which is in the between the neck and the diaphragm, Tiferet gets lowered to the level of Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. So it can be anywhere within those three. Depending if it's a severe, it's something they should have done and they really didn't do it, Tiferet can go all the way down to Yesod, just because it was that mitzvah wasn't done. And when they do, when teshuvah is done, the Tiferet goes back to its location. And we'll find out, actually, it can go as high as Bina. The third level, with respect to Asiyah, is when a person transgresses a positive mitzvah in such a way as to damage Bina and cause it to descend, thereby causing Asiyah to descend to the last three Sephirot of the Klipot. When he repents, it is also considered tashuv hay, returning the hay, since teshuvah is from bina, and its power goes down and extends until malchut. then Malchut and Tiferet will return together, for Bina descending causes them to join, and this itself is Teshuvah. Going back to the earlier explanation that I spent a little bit of time on, because I left out an important aspect, is to visualize two men standing on each other, one standing on the head of the other one. The one, the lower one, is considered the negative let me rephrase that. Visualize two men lying on the ground with their feet touching. One man represents the klipot and the other man represents the positive inclination, the good inclination. So when a mistake is done, like a mitzvah is not done, it depends on the strength or the importance of that mitzvah and how it relates to those, to what happens. But essentially, if the mitzvah is not done, and if we're talking, it's the first level is that the head falls down into the chest, but then the chest falls down into the lower part of the body, and the lower part of the body falls into the lower part of the body of the negative system. So you see how the men, you visualize the men compressing into each other. And when Teshuvah is done, it just reverses that flow. I hope that's a clear picture for you.
Yes, that's good.
So we're talking now about the third level. We just did that. We just finished the third level. So I'm at the point where it's bride and groom unite under a chuppah. They embody Tiferet and Malchut. The light of Bina descends to engulf and unite them. They are surrounded by the light of Bina when they get married. It is clothed in the chuppah that it is used for the marriage ceremony. The chuppah represents Bina. In order for opposites to unite, an energy that transcends them both must be drawn. Remember, in spirituality, opposites do not attract, they repel. So in order on the spiritual level to unite opposites, something has to push them together that overpowers their repulsion, like two magnets that are facing the wrong way. We've all played with that when we were children. We try to put the magnets together and it would pop out the side. But if you have a enough power to push them together, you could push them together and you could hold them together. And that's what that's describing. Continuing to read. In order for opposites to unite, an energy that transcends them both must be drawn. And this is part of the reason why Teshuvah comes from Bina, the eighth Sephirah, the transcending force of this universe of 7 days or seven directions. And this is footnote 13, which is at the bottom of the page. This, How do we have seven directions? We have the six directions, north, south, east, and west, up and down. Those are the six directions. Those are the six ends. Those are the six sephirot. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between these three things that I just mentioned. But the seventh is the middle point. On the sephirot, it's malchut. But in the middle point, this is a concept that we don't really visualize in the Tree of Life, in the glyphs that we've been confused by. Where is the middle point? In Rabbi Ashlag's 10 Luminous Emanations, it explains about the middle point, that the Tzimtzum withdrew around the middle points. Can you have a middle point in a square? It's important to answer that question. If you're on a piece of paper and you draw a square, if you put a pencil right at the middle of the box that's got empty space, is that the middle point of the square? The middle point is essentially a discussion that the Tzimtzum had to withdraw in a circle, not a square. And that may take some contemplation, although it seems simple the way I described it just now. It's important to contemplate why a square cannot have a middle point. A cube can have a middle point because you can fit a sphere into a cube. But in the spirituality, the difference between a sphere and a cube is quite significant. I'm returning to where we were reading. The fourth level is when a person transgresses a positive mitzvah in such a way as to damage chachma, causing it to separate from keter. When such a person repents, does teshuvah, it is returning the hay as well, even though we're dealing with the level of chachma, since he causes the upper hay to return to keter, at which time Chachma will ascend with it. We have now explained the first division of atonement. Now, is everything clear as mud? Nobody wants to answer.
Well, we have a generalization. That when we transgress a positive mitzvah, we're separating the tetragrammaton, all four letters, really.
Potentially, it's all four letters. It's mm-hmm. the kind of thing, if you do a... If you don't bake challah on one Friday night, or for one week, is that so severe that you're having chachma descend? No. But if you don't bake challah for a year, the repetition of the mistake, it becomes severe and chachma can be separated. And we can't know, or we do not yet know, at what level or what constitutes that severity. That's the part of the judgment that has to take place through the Bet Din, or directly from Hashem. And it's also relative to the soul involved. So someone who was the only reason that they're in this world is to bake challah, that's the mitzvah that they have to refix. They have to fix and redo. For that person to not bake challah for a week could very well separate chachmah. But for most women or most people, baking the challah would only affect, you know, don't bake challah for 1 week. It's really not going to be such a sin that it would rise to the level of chachmah or even bina. But you do it consistently, and that adds to the severity. But it's also always relative to the soul involved.
Well, don't you think, too, the Kavanah? Because let's say this week, I prefer to go to a movie. I prefer to go to movies, but instead of baking challah. It would be different if I'm sick, not feeling well. So Kavanah would also play into it.
It's not really Kavanah. What it is the blockages that are in place. How difficult is it to do the mitzvah? For there's a reason why you got sick. That sickness, remember the discussions that we've had previously, where if you make a mistake in your tikkun, they're always going to give you another chance to do that same tikkun, but mm-hmm. It will be more difficult. So the reason you got sick on Friday night was to make it more difficult to cook the challah. So it's not really Kavanah. Your intention, the intention is the consciousness you use when you bake the challah. If your consciousness is, I'm really sick and I'm tired and I don't want to be doing this, or your consciousness is, I really want to give my children and my family love, and that's what I'm injecting into the challah. But there's a fine distinction between the two, Anna.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's recognizing the blockages. You only became sick. You came down with the sniffles, so you would give yourself an excuse not to bake challah that day. Continuing to read. It must have been a reason that I have brought up the idea of baking challah, because I was looking for an example to use, and that's what popped into my head.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just finding, you know, that women do so many other mitzvot, but the three that that are encumbered upon us, they don't see it. They're doing other things, but not the baking of the challah.
No, women have been given a leniency that they can go out and buy the challah. It's a lot easier to go buy a challah, but not in Louisiana where you're living, but in Los Angeles and in New York and in Chicago, women don't bake challah. They go to the bakery and buy it.
Well, see, Israel was like that too.
Who was? Israel was like that too, yes. It's the same issue. They don't, because they don't understand the importance of the mitzvot. You know, it's common. It's every day. It's, I'm baking challah. What's the difference between breaking challah and frying a steak? God forbid you fry, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, there's also an example. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's examples of, you know, from the male side, it's, you know, I don't feel like laying tefillin today, so, you know, I don't lay it. What did I lose? One day out of a year, I didn't lay tefillin. But in reality, I brought the whole level of the Sephirot down into the Klipot. And if I do that, you know, a day a week for a year, who knows, you know, how much I did. Did I get up to Hakma with that? We just don't know. But that's what the emphasis is. That's what this section is trying to get across to us.
Well, with the challah, there's an example in the Tanakh where a time will come or did come where it would take 9 women bringing their batch of challah, you know, to just make one loaf. It's always,
right.
You know, the side is, you know, that's a severe famine.
That's a severe famine. But even with the severe famine, they were able to do it. But it was all these blockages that were cleansing whatever action it was, more than likely not baking challah when they could have in previous lifetimes.
Then there's other levels, because I tried to say, please make it par, because when you bring it to the synagogue, if they've got a meat meal, there you're guilty of, you've got butter in your challah and you've caused something else. it gets bigger as you go.
Butter in your challah, it's not challah, is it? It's egg, you know, it's, if you put eggs in it, it's not a challah. But we have leniencies that say, you know, go ahead and use egg challah on Friday for your blessings. But that's, the people who are giving those leniencies are not really knowledgeable on the Kabbalah. They don't understand the impact. That's not to say that there isn't a reason why sometimes those leniencies are important.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
I was waiting for you, Brandy.
Okay. Thank you. What if you are gluten intolerant and you can't eat challah?
Well, you make gluten-free bread.
They're recipes.
Okay.
It's hard to braid.
Okay.
You can't really braid it, but you can buy the pan that has the braided shape. You know, if you know anybody that needs a recipe, I have recipes for. In fact, I've got ingredients in my freezer because I had planned to have a second workshop for those that had problems. And so I had to buy some special ingredients, and they're in the freezer. But I wanted to keep them separate from the other ladies, you know, because my kitchen is small and I felt like it was too much to do too many things at one session.
One of my students here is a woman who's lactate intolerant and gluten intolerant and peanuts intolerant, and literally everything that's served for Shabbat Oneg, for Shabbat Joy, she can't eat. And when you meet her, the personality makes very clear why she has these additional blockages in this lifetime. Should I continue to read?
Continue on.
We could stay on hold for a long time. Okay, thank you, though.
Thank you.
All of you three are welcome. One example of this is when someone learns Torah in a manner of amassing data without reverence for God. The Torah comes out from Chachma, the Zohar tells us. This means the place from which it is revealed, but its hidden source is Keter. In order to access the true light of the Torah, one must draw from the Keter. This involves learning with reverence for God, and also that the learning experience be geared to an uplifting of consciousness. What this is saying is, when you scan the Zohar, if you're doing it because it's a chore, that's not an uplifting consciousness. I was speaking to one of my students today, and she has been studying Kabbalah for 15 years. First with the Kabbalah Center for 7 years, and then 8 years with B'nai Baruch. And I said to her, are you saying the Anna B'Koch every day? No, that's voodoo stuff. I don't have to do that. I don't want to do that. It doesn't make sense to me to do it. How do I get across to her? And it's not me, it's how does Hashem get across to her that if you utilize the Anna B'Koach, all of these things that are bothering her and that's chaos in her life are going to be managed and reduced. And the only explanation I came up with is, you're unhappy. What can you do? What's your alternative to saying the Anna B'Koach to fix the unhappiness? And her response initially was, I don't have anything else, but I'm not going to do this anyway. By the end of our conversation, she is now, I hope she's thinking about doing it. She didn't come out right and say, I will do it, but she did say she will think about it. And it's a question, you know, if you guys go back to your initial time when I would say the Anna B'Koach, the Satan comes up and battles us on that. But unless you realize that that's what's happening, it's just very difficult. If you don't recognize that it's coming from Satan, you think it's your normal thinking. It's the Western world's teaching of logic and rationality. And this is what we face in our generation. I'm sorry to say.
I know the other day, most every day, if I don't say it in the morning, I say it at night, the Anna B'Koach. And I had chaos in my life Friday. I slipped and fell in the kitchen and fell on my face. And the minute I fell down, do what?
I said, I'm sorry to hear you fell on your face, but I hope you bounced.
Well, I tried, but it didn't work. So anyway, while I was down on the floor, the first thing that came to mind was to say the Anna B'Koach. and I started saying the antibiotic, and I got mostly through it. And I finished it when I got myself together and noticed that there was blood all over the floor, and I was afraid to go look in the mirror, but it was my arm, my left arm, that had blood on it. So, yeah, I really do believe antibiotic. Yep, it works. It works. I ended up with a black eye. It looked like I'd been in a bar fight. But there's good that came from that, because the way the black eye manifested, it looked like I had charcoal eyeshadow on. So that was a good thing.
So from now on, you're going to have charcoal eyeshadow because you look better, right?
Right. I thought, oh, now when I go to synagogue tonight, I can put charcoal eyeshadow on the left eye, and nobody will know, and no one will notice, you know? But I tell you, black eye, cut arm, bruised right arm, couldn't lift. Oh, well, there's a reason. Whatever. You got to laugh at it.
I wonder if your person that you mentioned, you know, when you do things over and over and over every day, after a while, you know, you get, I don't know, it just gets stale, I guess you'd say.
It becomes a habit. It's you know, and that's the regulation. I don't mean to interfere, you know, to cut you off on it, but it becomes rote. And that is the issue, because literally for me, every Rosh Hashanah, I have to up what I'm doing. I have to increase something that I'm doing spiritually. Because if I don't, as soon as I hit Cheshvan, it just hits me in the face.
Well, I find if I go back, because I keep the copy, and then on the back side, you know, I think it's Kabbalah for All, has a real good explanation. So if you reread that, it kind of refreshes and kind of puts a spring back into it.
Right.
And then also I have a card with just the letters, because I was trying to map out where I saw words or letters or, you know, within that. But then by taking the letters and putting the vowel sounds like we do with the 72 names, I find that that also kind of gives a fresh, you know, freshness to it. And
yes, it does.
And back to singing the whole thing, it's like it's fresher again. So maybe just a little bit of change and from time to time, what we put in that first few classes, the meaning behind it, and even the idea of, you know, stories we've heard of, like one woman was on her way to the Twin Towers where she worked on 9/11. And then she remembered she hadn't said the Anabakoach, so she went back home to her apartment and said the Anabakoach. But she missed the destruction of the Twin Towers. It saved her life. And it's things like that that you bring back to me that you educate. That kind of helps with anything, you know.
Of course. I'm going to need to keep reading now.
Okay.
This content poignantly expresses what is considered to be an underlying cause of the desolation of the land of Israel. after the destruction of the first temple. So says Hashem, because they abandoned my Torah. This means that they did not bless on the Torah first, before their Torah learning. It is the blessing on the Torah that draws from Keter, the first of levels, into Chokmah. The word bracha literally means a fountain of the light of the Infinite One shining into Chokmah. One who does not do this lacks the fulfillment of the root of the positive mitzvot. This is the idea behind the fourth level of not doing a positive mitzvah. My commentary. From the reading in section 3, and this section from the beginning of 4a to now, we need to realize that tikkun always relates to a mitzvah. The actions of the mitzvot are simple and easy to do. The addition of having the proper timing of the ritual and the proper kavanah of the ritual is not easy. From this statement, I realize that there are five components completely in a righteous manner that is the cause of the breaks mentioned above as different levels of teshuvah that must be done to repair our mistakes, errors, and sins. What are these five components of the mitzvah? We've always talked about four. What's the fifth? What do you learn from this idea? Anybody want to guess?
I'm not sure what you ask. I had a lot of crackling sound on my end.
Yeah, we're having a lot of background noise. What I'm asking, when I read this section, I realized that there are actually five components to making a righteous action. Up till now, we've talked to do a righteous action, you have to be at the right time, the right place, the right action, and the right kavanah. But in the above paragraph, there's a fifth item. The fifth item is you have to know, and we really don't know, what the mitzvah, what is the tikkun that we are correcting with the doing of the mitzvah. Because our consciousness is creating everything. And it's always relative to the souls involved. So that's why the sages have never said to us or given us lists or explaining how this mitzvah relates to that tikkun, because it's always related to the souls. And to truly become a righteous person at the highest level, you have to include that understanding. The solution, when you don't know, is to do a L'shem Yichud. because that is establishing the kavanah for your action.
Mm-hmm.
It's connecting you to Hashem. That's the fifth component. You have to be connected to Hashem. And we think that comes from the kavanah, but it doesn't. The kavanah. You give charity to someone. You give a dollar to a homeless person. What's your kavanah? You're trying to help him? Then you would give him a meal, or you would give him more than a dollar. What's the purpose of the dollar? What's the purpose of that interaction? There's a tikkun there between you and that other person's soul. Remember the teaching, Hashem creates the poor person for the rich person. We have to be connected to Hashem. And the L'shem Yichud is a quick way of doing that. What's your thinking? Is this a good place to stop?
Well, you don't think we ought to read preparation of components of the mitzvah and then stop?
Okay, we'll do that. I'm just looking at...
Is our time already gone?
I'm sorry?
I just wondered if an hour had passed so quickly.
Well, so we have 10 minutes left, but there's not, in those 10 minutes we won't finish it, and this is a good place to...
If we're not going to finish it, it would be a good place to stop, to review the five components, you know, before we start again. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah. Right, because normally I'll continue to say in classes that it's the four components because it's difficult to explain to someone who hasn't connected to Hashem, doesn't really know how to connect to Hashem quickly and easily. It becomes that voodoo thing, that mystical stuff. And it's too easy for people who are not, who have not been studying for a while, to make that connection. So if you do hear me say four components, you understand why it's not five, but it really is five.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what we covered today with the example you gave us, it really helped. It helped that second, third, and fourth level a lot. And
yes.
I think it really impressed upon us when we transgress upon positive man, what damage we're causing. So this was, I really think this helped us a lot with this chapter. That last week, I know my head was swimming, and it was the second time we had gone over it, and I wasn't too sure it was because I hadn't slept with Tony being sick. But anyway, this really helped. I'm not so sure, though, but the square and the center point of a square, when you ask the question right at first, could you have a midpoint in a square, I thought the lines of the square would move just like the Sephiroth move and go from four corners to a round circle. So that was the only thing that...
It's because you were thinking physically.
Okay.
The four sides of a square represent this thing's actions, whereas it's, the circle represents continuity, continuous action. They're not distinct. But we're talking on a spiritual level, not the physical. And when you you heard me describe a square, what's the midpoint of a square, you naturally think in terms of, you know, a piece of paper with a square drawn on it. Everybody does. I do it. I'm not criticizing it. That's just the nature. But when we're talking in Kabbalah, we're always talking at the spiritual level. So what does a square represent in the Kabbalah, in the spiritual level? It represents the four phases. It represents the process of creation. But what's the midpoint of a process of creation? There is no midpoint, because you start at the beginning and you're not complete till the end. So there's no midpoint. Unless you say, well, the end, the manifestation is my midpoint. But that doesn't make any, you know, it's too hard to fathom. But the midpoint of the circle, you can understand from the standpoint that a circle is continuous. So that the midpoint is where all the diameters cross.
Well, probably my reason was because I used to use yarn, even to pass out in my classes to show how to braid challah. And for some reason, when you said the square, the circle and the square, I thought of my piece of yarn. But you try to make a square with yarn, you're not going to get those corners. So it still goes along with your help.
When you look at a square, when I see a square, I see four dimensions. And the center is a fifth dimension.
That's correct. But the center isn't a fifth dimension spiritually. Because what is the meaning of a square in spirituality versus the meaning of a circle in spirituality?
Well, if you have the four phases, what about the four dimensions? Or the four planes of existence?
The four dimensions are the four worlds.
Right.
But there's a fifth world, right?
Right, right. There's a fifth world.
Okay, but the fifth world and the four worlds are in a line. They're not in a circle, are they?
No.
Now I'll show you how they can be in a circle. If you imagine the glyph that has the circles on it, you have 10 circles, one within each other. But how do you get from one circle to the next inner circle, and then to the next inner circle? You have to draw a line between them.
Okay, I can see that.
And that's why the image of the tzimtzum, you withdraw to the outer edge of the circle. You withdraw in a circle. Now you enter again, you come back in from the standpoint of a line. But you bring that line down just to the next inner circle. Then you have to create that inner circle, the next inner circle, before you take the line further down to the second inner circle. But that's what we cover in the 10 luminous emanations.
Which so they're all really overlapping.
Yes, they're all overlapping. Yes.
So it makes one continuous circle from one end to the, from the beginning to the end. Because there is
but
no
that,
end.
If you're going to make it, but if you're going from the beginning to the end, you're talking about a line, not a circle.
Okay.
Well, the visualization I got, which is probably completely out, is to me one slipped below the other, and it was almost like then it became like a tube.
Right.
And tubes together rather than a line.
But the tube becomes a funnel. Each circle on the funnel is a little smaller as it goes down. But in essence, that's a line.
Okay.
We can talk about it at questions and answers on Wednesday if it's still confusing.
Well, there is something to be said for the fifth dimension.
Yeah, I like their songs.
And there's a great show.
You have a beautiful evening, all of you.
Okay,
you
thank
too.
You.
Thank you.